Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. The nuclear deal in the works with Iran has got everybody worked up. The Obama administration is cautious but sees a diplomatic coup, and there have been cheers here and in Tehran. Many in Congress worry the Obama administration has been duped by a clever Iran. Saudi Arabia and Israel are angry, afraid that the U.S. is slowly but surely getting closer to Iran at their expense. And with the whole Middle East seeing deep, unsettling change, figuring out the future has rarely been as hard. This hour on Point, the Iran deal, the Middle East, and a grand strategy. You can join us on air or online. What do you think? A good deal? A done deal? A bad deal? Do we need this? Do you trust Iran to hold up its end of the bargain? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Washington is David Ignatius, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post. David, so nice to have you as always. Thanks.
Thank you, Jane.
So after a few days to digest the specifics here, what's your reaction to this deal?
Well, I think three or maybe four things have become clear as the dust has settled since the Thursday announcement. The first I'd say is that among many American analysts who've looked at the deal, the initial judgment is one that I reached, I should make clear, but I think many others did too, that this is somewhat better and tougher than had been expected in the weeks immediately before the negotiation, when there was a sense that Secretary of State Kerry was rushing toward a deal, that compromises were being made, that it might be softer than the administration wanted. In fact, in many areas dealing with centrifuges, the size of the stockpile, verification measures, the provisions are somewhat tougher than people might have thought. Second point that's emerged is that there's a significant difference between the ways in which the United States has characterized what was agreed in its four-page fact sheet and the way the Iranians have characterized it, both in the joint statement that was read by their foreign minister, Javad Zarif, and the European representative at the Thursday announcement, and subsequently in their version of the fact sheet. They don't square on some key points. I think the two most important areas of difference are, first, the pace at which sanctions would be relieved, and then second, the terms that would apply to Iranian research and development on centrifuges and nuclear technology in the out years of this agreement. It's very hard to see in the two drafts just what the agreement is. Then the final point I would make is that it's clear a few days later that congressional concern and potential ability to make trouble for the agreement is still very much a factor. Congressional voices have been raised saying that the U.S. was duped, that more pressure would have brought a better deal, et cetera. So it's going to come down to very tight vote counting. It was interesting to me that yesterday on Face the Nation, Senator Lindsey Graham said that he was inclined to give the administration the 3 months needed to June 30, the formal expiration date of negotiations, to see what it could come up with. On the other side, it was interesting today that Senator Mark Warner, a Democrat, announced that he favored some kind of congressional review of the deal that was adding a new voice against. So I'd say as people step back and look, you know, I generally recognition this is a big diplomatic achievement on its face, but also recognition that it has some problems that are ambiguities that need badly to be sorted out, and that this is not a situation where we have a deal that we can analyze. It's where we have the shape of a possible deal that could be affected by events over the next 3 months.
A lot to dig into here. Let's hear some sound first. Speaking from the Rose Garden of the White House, President Obama announced the framework deal with Iran, said that the agreement could be a path forward for an improved relationship with the country.
If Iran complies with its international obligations, then it can fully rejoin the community of nations, thereby fulfilling the extraordinary talent and aspirations of the Iranian people. That would be good for Iran, and it would be good for the world. Of course, this deal alone, even if fully implemented, will not end the deep divisions and mistrust between our two countries.
And here is Republican Senator Lindsey Graham yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation of South Carolina. He said that President Obama was not the right man to get a good deal with Iran, and he laid out some of the problems as he sees them.
This deal, I believe, leads to an Arab breakout. They're wanting a nuclear program like the Iranians, and I fear that Israel cannot live with this deal because it gives Iran too much capability and too much money to wreak havoc throughout the region.
So there's Senator Graham, David Ignatius, talking about how this could be an Arab breakout. How could this deal still fall apart, generally speaking, and specifically in Congress?
Well, it could fall apart if the two sides are unable to get to a shared final version of the agreement they both can sign off on. It seems as if in the final hours of negotiations, there were certain items that were still in brackets, as negotiators said. They didn't quite have agreement on the language. And I think they just went forward with those brackets still there. In other words, to be decided. If they can't be decided in a way that both sides are comfortable with, the deal falls apart on its own. Second, it's possible that Congress could move to enact additional sanctions, say this deal is inadequate. The way to get to where we want to be at the end of June is to turn the screws tighter. Almost certainly that would result in the Iranians leaving the table. The idea that the Iranians respond to pressure in the short term by capitulating is misconceived. I think the question that you raised in citing Senator Graham's remarks yesterday is one of the toughest. Is it possible that this deal, by giving Iran what sometimes is called nuclear threshold status, all but a bomb, you know, 1 year, being generous, 1 year breakout time to having a bomb, will lead other nations in the region, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt, the UAE, to demand essentially the same deal.
Mm-hmm.
If that happened, that would set the stage 10 years or so from now for a genuinely dangerous proliferation of nuclear technology in the region, the spread of enriched material that could leak to terrorist groups and others. So that's a real concern, and unfortunately, there's nothing in this deal that I can see that addresses adequately that concern, that this destabilizes the region and will make Arab countries want the same thing that Iran is being given.
Hmm. Let me dig into your point about sanctions, because there seems to be a question about the pace and timing of the lifting of sanctions. Speaking last Thursday at a press conference in Switzerland, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Zarif, said that sanctions will be lifted, which is a big sticking point for Iran, although there's some ambiguity about when exactly those sanctions will be lifted.
All Security Council resolutions will be terminated. All U.S. nuclear-related secondary sanctions, as well as EU sanctions, will be terminated when we implement our measures. There won't be no sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran.
So, David Ignatius, the U.S. has said they would phase out sanctions. Iran believes those sanctions will be lifted immediately. Which is it?
Well, if you listen carefully to Zarif, he said that sanctions would be lifted when we have implemented the terms of the agreement. The U.S. fact sheet says pretty much the same thing, but is vague on what that means. What does it mean when you've implemented the terms? I mean, that could be a formal signing up. It could be the conclusion of a lengthy round of IAEA inspections to verify compliance. And I think that the reason this is fuzzy between the two versions is because it's fuzzy in fact. I think this was something where they weren't able to get to precise clarity. And just to give your listeners a little bit of background, this issue of how sanctions would be removed from Iran after the deal was made has been one of the sticking points of negotiations at least since last December. It's one of the most contentious issues. The Iranians have said, we need this to show our people that they're getting something out of the deal. And the U.S. response from Secretary Kerry has been, no, you have to earn each reduction of sanctions by showing that you're living up to the terms of the agreement. and that's been a point of bitter contention. As I read the agreements Thursday night and had to file on deadline, I thought that there was evidence the U.S. had backed away from that calibrated, earn your way to the next reduction of sanctions, because I didn't see any language like that. I saw fuzziness, but none of that. That's going to be a crucial issue going ahead.
What about the efficacy of sanctions, David Ignatius? It's been reported that Iran had about 200 centrifuges in 2003. Today it has some 19,000 centrifuges and has funded and advanced its breakout time to about 2 to 3 months. They've got thousands of nuclear scientists in Iran, technicians and such. What about the efficacy of sanctions there? Doesn't sound like continued sanctions would halt Iran's nuclear program at all.
I think the idea that sanctions have crippled the Iranian economy, people often refer to crippling sanctions, is a misconception. I was in Iran in December of 2013, but well after the sanctions had been in place for some time, and I was not looking at an economy that was crippled. What the sanctions have done is add to the sense in Iran that they are isolated from the global economy. They make it much harder to do business. One businessman told me that to get around sanctions adds 6 or 7 percentage points to the financing of a deal, let's say. So if the trade financing normally would be 8%, it would go up to 15%, let's say. So they get around it, but they feel isolated. Iranians want to be part of the same world that we're in. One reason President Rouhani was elected was he said, we don't want our friends just to be Russia and China. We want our friends to be all over the world. Mm. So that's a powerful theme. The people who were cheering in the streets when the agreement was announced, I think we're cheering above all for this idea, we're going to join the world. So it's not just sanctions relief. It's coming back to a world that accepts Iran as a significant country.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Iran nuclear deal and how it may play into events across the Middle East, now seeing more turmoil and change than ever before. My guest this hour, David Ignatius, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post. I'd like to bring one more voice into the conversation now. Peter Harling joins me from Beirut, Lebanon. He is senior advisor for the Middle East for the International Crisis Group. He recently co-authored an essay called The Islamic State Through the Looking Glass. It's a fascinating look at the flux and change right now across the Middle East. You can find a link on our website, onpointradio.org. Peter, welcome.
Thank you, Jane.
Before we begin, let me hear from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. This is yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press. Netanyahu saying flatly that the nuclear deal with Iran is a mistake.
The preeminent terrorist state of our time should not have access to a vast nuclear capability that will ultimately give them nuclear weapons. That's a concern for Israel, for the region, for the peace of the world.
So there is Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Peter Harling. Talk to us about this deal and put it in the context of a broader Middle East at a time of enormous change, enormous uncertainty in the region.
Well, I think you've just put it very well. It's certainly a good deal on paper, if you judge on its own merits. But the issue is the context in a region which is in a state of flux and profound anxiety, which is full of factions and players who are committing all crimes, all sorts of crimes, and engaging in a variety of interventions. And we're in a region where we see constant escalation in the forms and levels of violence witnessed on the ground. So the problem here is that the deal, although it may be very good on paper, has been negotiated in ways which has given rise to distrust, I think, of Iran and also of the U.S. administration. And that's an issue that needs to be addressed, I think, by both these two parties to the deal. A deal that serves their interests, of course, but what about the interests of others in the region who may not be fully satisfied by what they see on paper?
So if someone asks you, Peter Harling, does this Iran deal help stabilize the Middle East or further destabilize it, do you say yes, no, or wrong question?
Well, whatever I say would be a hunch, and I think we'll have to judge the deal on the basis of its outcome. And I think here the problem is that both Iran and the U.S. administration initially wanted to have a broad conversation about all the problems that exist within the relationship within the two and in terms of how they engage with the region. Then both sides, Iran and the U.S. administration, decided to de-link the nuclear file and treat it as a discrete technical issue, disconnected from all the other ramifications of this relationship. Right. The problem is that it's impossible to do so in practice. We've seen over the past few years a trend towards growing empowerment of Iran and behavior on the part of Iran, and that may be true of other players too within the region, but which is a cause for concern vis-a-vis other players, you know, ordinary Syrians, mm-hmm. Part of Iraqi society, but also indeed countries like Israel and Saudi Arabia and others who I think all too easily dismissed as hysterical for expressing and indeed expressing often in very awkward ways this anxiety they feel at the fact that the deal may serve the interests of the U.S. administration and Iran, but at their own expense.
Well, talk about Saudi Arabia specifically. Are they at all wary of a reemerging partnership, if you will, between the United States and Iran?
I sense in Saudi a rather different reading, that the U.S. will not necessarily jump ship, but seek another balance in their relationships with players in the region, and possibly go back to what prevailed under the previous regime in Iran, under the Shah, whereby the U.S. had a two-pillar relationship with the region based on a strong relationship with Saudi Arabia and another strong relationship with Iran, sometimes playing one against the other. But I think the idea that the U.S. would go all the way and, you know, abandon its traditional allies and just, you know, develop an alliance as such with Iran, I think is a bit far-fetched.
So while negotiators were working in Switzerland, so much was going on in the Middle East. Iraqis were fighting ISIS into Crete, Saudi Arabia escalating its push into Yemen, extremists taking over a Syrian border crossing with Jordan. You wrote this fascinating essay about all of this. Give us the broad headline, the thesis. What do you believe is happening here? What are you trying to get across?
Well, I think the region is undergoing a set of conflicts and crises which are interrelated in ways that are just too complex, I think, for us to engage with intellectually, let alone articulate compelling policies that could address such challenges. And I think as a result, we've been jumping from one posture to the next, been caught up in a number of distractions, failed to address any of the problems that have been building up in the region, leading into the ascent of the Islamic State. And the Islamic State has been, a savior of sorts, coming to save us from all our past failures, defining itself as an enemy, and of course in very spectacular ways, which feed into, kind of spectacular politics, and has led us to, I think, turn our back on all these problems which we failed to address and refocus entirely on this new war on terror, although I think all the concern now engaged in the war on terror had come to conclude that the war on terror waged under the Bush administration had been part of the problem. And I feel, just to go back to the Iran deal, that some of the hopes being pinned on the deal and its possible consequences, ushering an entirely new dynamic in the region and so on and so forth, are another way, I think, of fleeing our failures in the region rather than tackling them head on.
Hmm. Let's get a caller in here. Alan is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Alan. You're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Jane, David, Peter, how are you? Good to be on the show. Two points I want to make here. One is our President Obama stated Iran could fully join the community of nations by agreeing to this deal, and I fail to understand how that can transpire when Iran is the premier state sponsor of terrorism in Beirut, Lebanon, Bulgaria, Argentina, and many other places, and they're going to continue this behavior because there's been no codicil or anything outlining that they're going to stop this behavior. And the second point I think is even more important is that we've now lost the trust of Saudi Arabia through this deal and many others in the Middle East. And Saudi Arabia, I think, is now looking to Pakistan to get ICBMs and nuclear weapons to fully nuke up, if I may use that term, protect against Iran that will surely go nuclear if they've got underground facilities and the tons that nobody's looking at. Iran's definitely going to get a nuclear weapon. Their primary target is not Israel, but Saudi Arabia and Mecca.
Alan, thank you. David Ignatius, I'll bring you back in here. What do you make of Alan's point, specifically that perhaps some of the Gulf states like Saudi Arabia have lost trust in the U.S. with this deal?
Well, they had been losing trust really ever since the departure of Hosni Mubarak as president in Egypt, and they felt abandoned. I think what the White House and State Department would say, looking at this very chaotic region, looking at Iran using its proxies in countries from Iraq to Syria to Yemen to Lebanon, I think their answer would be they don't expect that to change. That wasn't really what the nuclear deal was about. And in that sense, there is separation of the regional file from the nuclear file. And second, precisely because Iran is so dangerous, such a destabilizing regional force, it's important to the extent possible for the next 10 to 15 years to take its ability to make a nuclear weapon away. So in this period of great flux and transition, this historic period that will last through our generation, at least for much of it, Iran's nuclear capability will be limited. That would be the argument. A second point I'd make briefly, Jane, is that I'd say the administration has a it's back in the time of the Iran-Iraq war, we used to call the U.S. policy dual containment. Maybe now it's dual engagement. Very specifically, in the last several weeks, as the U.S. was moving toward this deal with Iran, it also moved to bolster the Sunni states militarily, so that they posed a stronger challenge to Iran in these regional fights. For example, the U.S. has supported with intelligence and other assistance Saudi bombing of the Houthi rebels in Yemen, despite some misgivings on the U.S. side that this will be very effective. The U.S. wanted to stand behind Saudi Arabia and see them push back against what they saw as the Iranian threat. Same thing in selling arms to Egypt's President al-Sisi, something the administration had been reluctant to do. They bit the bullet. They made this very real politic decision. You know, we need a strong Sunni backbone in this period of regional uncertainty, so let's make the Egyptians stronger. So I'd see those two points. You want to defang Iran to the extent you can, precisely because the region is so unstable, and in this unstable region, lean toward shoring up the Sunnis, even as you lean toward opening to Iran.
David Ignatius, thank you. Peter Harling, speak to Alan's other point. I mean, a lot of people, including him, sounds like, saying, how can we make a deal? How can we lift sanctions against Iran, which would essentially deliver billions of dollars to Iran? How can that be justified when Iran is still the main destabler in the Middle East? Peter Harling.
I think it's very much up to the Iranians to decide what kind of relationship they want with their immediate environment. It's up to them to deal and reach out when it comes to the Arab world and prove that they can be an accepted neighbor. One problem, I think, is that a broad-based perception in Iran and among Iranians abroad is that this deal was an outcome, a success, of Iranian regional policies based on resistance to a U.S.-imposed order, and support for a number of allies across the region. So it's unclear that the deal will actually lead the establishment, but also public opinion in Iran, to decide that they should shift their posture when it comes to the region, all the more so that the U.S. is signaling, indeed, as we heard on the part of Obama, that normalization on the international scene would be contingent on Iran's fulfillment of its obligations under the deal more than a deeper change in its regional posture. Now, here I think, contributing to the kind of distrust I mentioned earlier on is the fact that the U.S. has been contributing in a number of ways to Iranian empowerment over the years, although it didn't necessarily seek to do so. But the U.S., through its interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq, removed two or the overriding strategic challenges posed to Iran. But more anecdotally, in the recent period, we see U.S. aircraft, drones providing intelligence, which ultimately serves Shiite militias, engaging in land grabs in Iraq and reprisal killings and looting and whatnot. We've seen the U.S. Air Force acting in support. We have the Syrian helicopters dropping barrel bombs on civilians right after U.S. aircraft targeted Islamic State assets in Syria, for instance. So this is projecting an image in the region which I think is lost upon many of our decision makers in Europe and the U.S. But the perception is that the U.S. is deliberately going far towards Iran, and much farther than would be justified by the requirements of a deal.
Let me speak to inspections for a moment here. Here's U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry speaking to reporters in Lausanne on Thursday after the deal was announced, saying that the nuclear deal with Iran will ensure strict inspections of Iran's nuclear programs.
Not only will inspectors have regular access to all of Iran's declared facilities indefinitely, but they will also be able to monitor the facilities that produce the centrifuges themselves and the uranium that supports the nuclear program. And they will be able to do that for at least 20 years.
And here's Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, saying Iran will abide by the terms of the framework nuclear agreement reached last week. "We will if you will," was his message.
Whatever we told the world, whatever we promised, or whatever we will promise, we will honor those pledges. The world must know that we do not intend to cheat. We will keep our promises, of course, promises within the framework of our national interests, and we will honor these pledges, provided that the other side honors their promises as well.
David Ignatius, so much history here. Can Iran be trusted to comply, and how will we know if indeed they're cheating?
They're both great questions. In the broader scope of the last 30 years, you'd have to say Iran can't be trusted. They've been quite ruthless in pursuing their own interests. Since the provisional joint agreement was signed in November 2013, yes, the Iranians have, as near as we have been able to tell through monitoring, done what they said they were going to do. They, where they said that they would reduce enriching to a certain level, they seem to have done that. Where they made other pledges similarly. So they're saying we have a good track record since we entered into this process. I think the big question when I think about this issue, I'm curious what Peter Harling would say, is there a way in which this round of diplomacy can be part of revolutionary Iran turning a corner, as it were, turning a corner, as Henry Kissinger likes to say, away from being a cause toward being a nation. And as a nation, it would be recognized as a significant player in the region. But is it prepared to give up that revolutionary agitation and destabilization? That's what we most don't know. And I think it's frustrating for the administration wanting to affect Iranian behavior so that it is less of a destabilizing force not to have found ways to do that.
Peter Harling, in 20 seconds here before the break, do you agree? Is this a moment of truth, Iran turning the corner?
Well, I really think it's the right question to pose, and we will only have an answer to that months, if not years, from now. And thus the need, I think, to manage the perceptions and the anxieties in the meanwhile.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Iran nuclear deal in the context of a region going through incredible upheaval. And you can join the conversation. Is it time for a big rethink about Syria, Iraq, Iran, about our alliances with Saudi Arabia and Israel, about our message? My guests are Peter Harling in Beirut, Lebanon, senior advisor for the Middle East for the International Crisis Group, and David Ignatius, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post. Let's get some calls in here. Al is in El Reno, Oklahoma. Al, glad you waited. Thank you. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Yes.
I would like to pose the possibility or the reality that military action inside the Middle East has only made it worse at this point. Bibi Netanyahu is asking us to extend another, 10, 20 years, another generation of Americans while we support him wholeheartedly. I think it's time to shift the power dynamics towards maybe a peaceful solution, one that probably ought to be done or tried before we escalate to another military intervention that will take Americans possibly even into Iran. And I don't see that as being a way of honoring all the fallen people so far.
Al, thank you. Here's Ali in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Ali, welcome to the program.
Hello, Jane. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yes, of course.
There was a lot of questions that how Iran is going to behave, and also I'm going to say my point regarding what is wrong with this agreement. First, you know, in the new budget that Rouhani has approved, we see about 50% increase in the budget of Revolutionary Guards, despite all the problems that they have. They have 30% increase in the military budget. And at the same time, they have decreased the research project by about 10%.
And so what do you think of this agreement, Ali? Do you think it's a good idea moving forward?
Agreement. Yes. I believe in this agreement, something which is missing is the real long-term interest of Iranian people, Iranian and also American people, because the human rights and also the democracy does not have any role. Mm. And this is not something in theory. If you consider many other events that have happened regarding the relationship between Iran and U.S., for example, the coup against Mossadegh, at that time, that one was done under the auspice of the national interest of the U.S., namely oil. Mm. But we see that after that, what happened in the region? What kind of regime came out of that region?
So many questions, Ali. Thank you for calling. Let's get one more in here. Mona in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Mona. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I have a question and a comment. My question is that how is it that for Iran to create a stronger alliance with Russia, China, or other adversaries like Syria or even North Korea is not a bigger concern because they are an ambitious country and they're going to continue doing things like that. I think there is a truth into keep your friends close and your enemies closer.
Mm-hmm.
But my second comment is that I think when we look at historically sanctions, the only thing that it does is bring people to table for negotiation. There's nothing else it can do, like when we look at the sanctions against Cuba, Russia, or whoever. And we've accomplished that. We have them at the table negotiating. And if we don't negotiate with them, what's the alternative? They will, you know, if this whole thing falls through, the only thing, they're going to continue developing the bomb, and the only alternative is to go to war with them. So how is that a better alternative?
Mona, thank you. To Mona's point, Peter Harling, sort of broadly speaking here, what is the grand strategy at work in Washington now? And does this Iranian agreement help move that grand strategy forward, would you say?
Well, I think the administration has a very sophisticated narrative, which essentially veils the absence of a clear strategy. And in fact, as it seems, the U.S. is trying to disengage from the region to the extent possible, which makes sense coming on the tails of disastrous adventures in Afghanistan and in Iraq, which have been extremely costly to the U.S. state and people. The problem is that as the U.S. Disengages or attempts to, its presence on the ground is still felt. I mean, the U.S. is carrying strikes and is intervening in various parts of the region. It's supporting different players. But it's doing so in unintelligible ways, in shifting ways, in ways that add to the confusion. And meanwhile, state structures are eroding or collapsing in different parts of the region. And in that vacuum, what you have is unprecedented levels of regional interference by some states in neighboring arenas and conflicts. And that's really what needs to be regulated. And the problem we have is that the U.S. and other Western governments, in fact, in a knee-jerk response to the Islamic State, are empowering, funding, legitimizing anyone claiming to fight against them, very often pursuing completely different agendas in the meanwhile. So what we're doing is contributing to a region-wide arms race and to the, you know, the growth, the assertiveness of regional powers and proxies, which will make it even more difficult for the U.S. to disengage.
A region-wide arms race. Well, thank you very much, both of you, for your time today. Peter Harling, Senior Advisor for the Middle East for the International Crisis Group. So great to have you, Peter. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And David Ignatius, Foreign Affairs Columnist for The Washington Post. My thanks to you as well, David. Thank you.
Thanks, Jane.
Joining me now from Washington, Zbigniew Brzezinski, National Security Advisor to President Jimmy Carter from 1977 to 1981, currently counselor and trustee at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and Senior Research Professor of International Relations at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins. Dr. Brzezinski, so nice to have you with us. Thank you, sir, for being here.
It's very nice to be with you.
So first, what do you make of this Iran agreement?
Well, first of all, let me say that I didn't have a chance to listen to the predecessors, and I do have an appointment here in about 15 minutes, so I'm afraid I'm more strapped for time than we previously estimated. But so let's go ahead. My sense basically is that this is an important, a very important, potentially transformational step taken by the United States in the context of global chaos. And the United States has been able to engage in a collective stance, not only Europe, its allies, but Russia, currently its adversary in Europe, and China, a major world country, world power, but one which prefers not to be involved in local crises. I think that is a major accomplishment, potentially very important.
So why do you think, sir, that Russia and China were willing to work together with us on this deal? Do they fear a rising Iran as well?
No, I don't think it's an issue of fearing a rising Iran, but it is an issue pertaining to growing awareness that global chaos can consume all of us and destroy our various interests. So I applaud the attempt. It's not a foregone conclusion that it will be successful, but it's worth doing because the alternative, which is offered most forcefully by Mr. Netanyahu, is absolutely appalling, simply starting a war. And bear in mind that for a decade or so now, he has predicted every year that Iran will have the bomb within a year or so. So the alternative is not very sound, either in the solution nor in its predictions.
So President Obama has gone out of his way to emphasize to Israel that, you know, we've got your back in the face of any Iranian hostility. I think the president said, quote, I would consider it a fundamental failure of my presidency if on my watch or as a consequence of work that I have done, Israel was rendered more vulnerable. So is this nuclear deal good for Israel, would you say, Dr. Brzezinski?
I would think it's good for it and it's good for a lot of others. In brief, a regional war, which is likely to erupt if we have to participate in some attack on Iran, is not good for anyone. So I think this is good for Israel. And in any case, it's worth giving it a chance because, I repeat, the predictions on which policies of people like Netanyahu have been based. The prediction that Iran will have a bomb within a year has proven to be false already for a decade or so. So why not give this a chance? And that others are participating on such an important global scale enhances the possibility of its success. Because I should add that it also enhances the prospects of Iran itself being transformed. And it seems to me that Iranian public opinion is increasingly desirous of some fundamental changes in its orientation and its place in the world.
Senator John McCain, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, said that, quote, Iran is clearly on the offensive across the Middle East. Its activities from Iraq to Syria to Lebanon and Yemen are provoking a regional sectarian conflict of massive proportions. We cannot, we should not divorce our nuclear diplomacy with Iran from the larger strategic challenge that Iran poses. I'm curious what your reaction to that statement is from Senator McCain, Dr. Brzezinski.
My reaction is that while there is some truth to it, it's only some truth. The upheaval, the disruption, the uncertainties inherent in that region are partially Iran's doing. But they're also partially the doing of other Arab countries, some of which the senator actually views as friends. For example, Saudi Arabia. It's a very complicated issue in which no one is totally wrong and no one is totally right. The issue, the challenge, is how to deal with that condition. And you cannot deal with it simply by identifying one participant in that chaotic dynamic and then engaging in a war, and particularly in a war which will be then viewed by most Muslims as anti-Islamic, a war that America is engineering and is designed to satisfy the political aspirations of some politicians in Israel, fortunately not the majority of politicians in Israel.
Iranian President Rouhani said that Iran would continue to enrich uranium for peaceful purposes this weekend, but he hailed the framework, the agreement, as a new era of, quote, cooperation with the world. Do you believe him? Do you trust the Iranians, Dr. Brzezinski?
You know, I wouldn't put it that way. I neither trust them nor mistrust them. I have the sense that, by and large, this is a very sophisticated nation, which has been very successful for 2,500 years. So you don't dismiss its reasoning and its outlook lightly. I think there are changes taking place in Iran, and I think the reaction of public opinion, at least in the capital, in Tehran, to the announcement has been very positive. I suspect within the leadership itself there is a recognition that there is no benefit to Iran of a massive upheaval in the region.
This weekend, President Obama gave an interview to Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, and Mr. Friedman said he heard, quote, an Obama doctrine emerging in the president's remarks that engagement with countries we have long isolated, Burma, Cuba, for example, and now Iran, combined with meeting some core strategic needs, could serve American interests far better than sanctions, endless sanctions, and isolation. Dr. Brzezinski, do you see an Obama doctrine emerging here, especially after these meetings?
Yes, I think finally one is beginning to emerge in a coherent and binding fashion. The president made some of these points already shortly after becoming president or even just before. But now I think it's beginning to have a wider image. And as I said at the very beginning, one very important issue that confronts us collectively, the president is addressing head on. And to an amazing degree, he has been able to get the major European countries, Russia, our current enemy over Ukraine, maybe I shouldn't call it enemy, but antagonist in any case, China, who prefers to abstain, to agree with us. And that, I think, comes out of the fact that more and more people in the world recognize that what is happening is the possibility of massive global chaos with all of its negative consequences.
Well, with that in mind, sir, looking ahead, how do you see these negotiations? How will the debate over this agreement go in Washington, Dr. Brzezinski?
I think it's going to be very difficult. It's going to be nasty. It's going to be accusatory. is going to be very ad hominem. But I hope that in the process, more and more Americans will be educated as to how complex these issues are and how a war initiated particularly by us or with an ally is not a substitute for intelligence strategizing. I think that's going to be ultimately the winner, because I see already now in the public opinion polls a predisposition on the part of the American public not to opt for war, which is exactly what some senators are urging. One of them, for example, urging that Iran goes rogue. No, that America goes rogue. Mm-hmm. No, even more correctly, that Israel goes rogue. I think that is very unfortunate, because that oversimplifies the problem. I think a public debate is going to make the public feel somewhat the way I do. Success is not preordained, but I think it's certainly worth a chance, and particularly when it is the product of a broadly unified alliance spanning all the important countries of the world, literally almost all of them.
In our last 40 seconds or so here, Dr. Brzezinski, do you see a grand strategy in Iran after this agreement? Do you see a way forward here, a thaw in the 35-year Cold War between Iran and the U.S.?
If it is sustained, in other words, if the agreement, in effect, acquires a life of its own and is not only accepted formally within the prescribed deadline, but then goes on to generate consequences, yes. But this is why the next phase is so delicate and so important. And if it succeeds in establishing a life of its own, then that is truly a transformational action for which the president deserves a lot of credit, a lot of personal credit. But the other countries do as well, because they decided ultimately, despite their reservations, to go along with us, our allies more easily, Russians with great difficulty, the Chinese with some restraint. But it's a chance for the world.
Dr. Zbigniew Brzezinski, I appreciate so much your time. The clock is against me, sir. Thank you very much for being with us. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.